It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Valerie Still is Kentucky basketball's all-time leading scorer and rebounder, including both men and women. She scored 2,763 points, pulled down 1,525 rebounds, records that stand today. She had a long and successful professional career, most of it in Italy, before she returned to the U.S. and led the Columbus Quest to two straight championships in the American Basketball League. She's a charter member of the U.K. Athletics Hall of Fame and just this year was inducted into the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame. And those are just a few among many honors that she's earned for her basketball career, and as we'll learn in this conversation, she has accomplished and continues to accomplish some great things away from basketball as well. And her memoir, Playing Black and Blue, Still I Rise, was released last year. Valerie, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Keith, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on your program. I'm excited about getting back with the Big Blue Nation and talking with you a little bit.
Well, those connections last forever, I know, with teammates and coaches and friends. Yeah. And I know that'll always be part of you, and you'll always be part of the Kentucky fans' enjoyment of basketball here. I wanted to ask you, before we look back on those years, about your current work. You're back in New Jersey now, as I understand it, near your hometown of Camden. And tell us about what you're doing today.
Yeah, I'd moved back a few years ago. My son Aaron was in high school, and I thought he needed a little more structure, and so I ended up moving back to the East Coast and put him in a military academy, and ended up living back. My mother and father had died, and I ended up in the house that I had bought them while I was playing professionally in Italy, and so I came back to the East Coast and just kind of got refocused. And you know, you go through your life changes, and had a rebirth right back here in New Jersey. And it was kind of interesting, you know, full circle, coming all the way back and getting back to Camden and working in the school districts around in the New Jersey area.
You mentioned growing up in Camden and where you grew up and the situation in which you grew up. I guess competing was not really an option. You had, 10 siblings and faced a lot of challenges. Tell me about the childhood. What kind of kept you going through some challenging times there, and obviously some very enjoyable times as well, but it was not without its challenges.
As with anybody, I think life, you know, it puts us in positions that grows us and makes us who we are. And I wouldn't change anything. I am who I am today through those challenges and through those experiences. I don't call them challenges, just experiences. And so, I come from Camden, New Jersey. And, you know, it took me such a long time to even be able to say that, to be proud of being from Camden, New Jersey. But now I know that it's not where you come from, but it's about who you are. And so, yes, I come from a family of 10, extremely. I was the ninth of 10 children in public housing. And I had 5 older brothers, 3 older sisters, and kind of tagged nothing in the house to stay indoors for. And so I hung out with all my brothers. And it's kind of odd. I was at an event the other day, and somebody from my childhood was there, and they were like, "Val, we never thought you would have done. You were the quiet one. You were the one that was always, you know, kind of behind the scenes." And it's funny that my nature is really one of, you know, peace and just quiet. And, you know, I like nature and animals. And because I hung out with my brothers, I became extremely competitive. And being the ninth of 10 children as well, you're trying to, you know, gain some kind of agency. And so I ended up being extremely competitive, whether it was playing out on the basketball court in Camden, New Jersey. Basketball is king. I mean, lots of great athletes played on the court. Billy Thompson, Milt Wagner, Lance Ware this year will be at UK, is from Camden. Great athletes. And I just happened to be one of the girls at the time, and had to fight for everything I got. It's during a period when girls weren't allowed to play. So it's kind of interesting that's always been my MO, I guess, you know, this whole, in a way it's good because it made me competitive. It made me have to fight for everything I had. But at the same time, you know, I had to learn who I really was again, and that life isn't always about competing against others, but it's just about being who you are and knowing who you are.
And you had that interest in sports from the beginning, and as you say, kind of hanging out with your brothers, you were able to get in some good competition there. But and we'll get right back to basketball, but I did want to ask you about your interest in and your exceptional ability in music, too. That was an important part of your childhood, too, wasn't it?
Most definitely. My dad was an accomplished musician. He was very, very talented. And my mother, it was the 70s, 60s, 70s, and she thought I should do things that were ladylike. And so I showed an interest in music at an early age, played by ear. And then she started me with piano, and I played saxophone and trumpet and French horn and guitar and drums and just musically inclined. And she was hoping that I would take that route. Because that was ladylike. And somebody was asking me the other day, you know, about the music part, like if my life would have been, how different it would have been if I would have pursued music. And the way that I was competitive, I think I would have just been like a top-notch musician. So I would have probably excelled at that. But instead, I just, you know, I took the whole route of athletics and being outside and hanging out with my brothers and here we are today, you know.
Well, you got some great experience there playing against the other guys along with your brothers. And then as you began to develop in basketball, I know, as you said in the book, that when you began to play, especially in high school, first got started in high school, that you might have been, like a lot of girls at that time, maybe lacking in fundamentals just from not simply having an opportunity to play with coaching and attend camps and things like that. But how would you describe the girls' basketball programs where you were at that time?
Well, definitely at Camden High. At that time, pretty much across the country, women were just breaking into the athletic side. Title IX had just passed in 1972. I was in middle school at the time, and the first scholarships to colleges came in 78, the year before I came, you know, got my scholarship. And so sports wasn't a big thing for girls, even though there were AAU and those kind of opportunities. And so overall, it was at a certain level. And I just, for me, it was the passion, because I played so much and I played with my brothers. Then I naturally had, not naturally, because it didn't come naturally. People think like people are just born athletes, and it's not. It's, you know, that's something that I did all the time and loved to do. And so I became good at it. So I think that's what propelled me into having that kind of ability, was just that I loved playing. I loved being outside. There wasn't anything to do on the inside. We came from a poor background. And so sports was one of the avenues that gave me an outlet.
Now, I hope I've got the timing right here, but was it just before your senior year of high school that you were able to make the move to Cherry Hill, New Jersey? By that time, your older brother, whom you all call Barry, but better known to football fans as Art still, was in the NFL with the Kansas City Chiefs. And if I've got the story right here, he bought a house in Cherry Hill for the family. Is that right? And if so, how did that change your life?
Yeah. You know, the 60s were all about the civil rights and America going through all this racial tension. And here I am, a female, you know, the labels they put on me, female, poor, black. Mm-hmm. And so we go from an predominantly black, the ghettos, the slums of, you know, Camden, New Jersey. He's the second pick in the 1978 NFL draft. And we're like the Beverly Hillbillies. We end up going to this affluent Cherry Hill. Cherry Hill East, in fact, where a lot of the professional athletes from, you know, Philadelphia, the Eagles or Flyers or 76ers, Phillies, live in these suburbs. And he ends up getting us a house there. And I did my last year at Cherry Hill East, which was not looking back on it, it was a culture shock. But I think when you're following your passion, all those things just go to the side. You don't even see it. You're in a zone. And so, you know, we were excluded there because we were, you know, a minority family. It was predominantly white, you know, upper class. And we were coming in from, you know, the poor class and a minority. So definitely a challenge, but when you're in the zone and you don't understand that, you don't see all the labels that people are putting on you, then I think that's when real magic happens. And for me, it was just that. I, you know, ignorance is bliss, they say at times. And, you know, I don't know if I could make it now in that kind of situation because, you know, it is a challenge.
Yeah, and I guess now you, in a way, you know too much, I suppose. You have so much baggage going in. But it seems like if there's been a pattern through your life, it's that you've never been afraid of the next adventure. In fact, you usually are anxious to take it on.
Yeah, I think ignorance is bliss. You know, you just – and part of it – and I now with me sharing with – I go across the country, across the world, sharing with young people that – you know, you have to follow what's within you. You know, there's a passion within you. And, you know, my mom did not want me playing athletics. She did not want me on the basketball court. She couldn't see the vision. I couldn't even really see it. When I was playing, I wasn't playing because I thought I was going to be, inducted into a Hall of Fame or have a record at UK. I just did it because it was something in me that I just loved to do. And so, one of the things that I really try to get to young and old is that, you know, you've got to follow your passion. And so that's what I was doing.
And you had a chance to follow it further then. Once UK offered a scholarship, you were pretty certain right away that you wanted to accept and come to Lexington. Now, by that time, of course, Art had been here and moved on to the pros. What made you so sure that it would work for you the way it had for him? Or maybe not even similar to how it had for him, but what made it sure that it would work for you?
You know what, Keith, I can't even say. Again, it's just one of those things. And the other part of this that I found out later in life is, and I'm pretty sure we'll talk about it, is my family history, the Steele family.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so part of it is this drive, I think, when you tap into whether you call it this zone or where you're just embracing life as we're spiritual beings having a human experience. And so when you tap into it, you just go with it. And so everybody asks, well, how did you get to Kentucky? And yeah, Art went to Kentucky, loved it there, was comfortable there. But it was just something other than that, I think, that drew us to Kentucky. And years later, I found out that my ancestors were actually enslaved in Lexington, Kentucky. And so now I get to tell their story in a tone, not a tone, but at least shed some light on that whole experience as well. And so I think part of the drive for us to come back was that this pool with our ancestors. And their experience there was horrendous, much different than what Art and I experienced or our family experienced in Lexington. And so it's kind of interesting to see that come about because, again, when we were doing it, we didn't even know about it. And when I did my master's in African and African-American studies, then I found out all this history of what had happened. And so part of that pull, I think, was just, you know, it was part of my destiny that I was going to go to UK and do both Art and I do what we did.
And that has been an important part of your life in later years to continue to learn about that and to continue to tell that story. And I do want to get back to that in a few minutes. Now, when you arrived as a UK freshman, of course, the reality of actually being on campus and you have to get to know new teammates and get to know your coaches a little better. Of course, they've been involved in recruiting you, but still it was a brand new experience. And tell me about those early days at UK and what that was like for you.
Yeah, what, again, looking back on it, knowing what I know now, you know, I'm like, wow, how'd that even happen? And this historical moment when, especially for women's sports, where, you know, you're going from the AIAW into the NCAA, where, you know, the SEC conference, all these things, Title IX, coaches like Pat Head Summit. Well, she was Pat Head then. You know, it's all the start of this movement of women's basketball. And Debbie Yao, who's the sister of Kay Yao, who eventually Debbie Yao becomes, you know, the first female athletic director at D1 school. And everything just kind of fell into place coming to UK. For me, I was clueless about UK. I didn't know about, you know, the most dominant. And I say this without being biased. I know people go back and forth about UK basketball or college basketball, but UK for me is definitely the most dominant basketball program, collegiate basketball program, more championships. If you just across the board, more NBA guys that come out, and you know, if you look at it, it is the preeminent program. And so when I was coming out from high school, I didn't know any of that. I was clueless. And the women's program was definitely not even on the map, wasn't even looked at. I mean, it was second class. It wasn't, men's basketball was king. And so when I came in, you have Debbie Yao, who was just a top-notch coach, not at the level of people now, because everybody, Pat Summit was there and they were all starting to establish themselves. And then I come in with probably the most dominant class that has, as far as women basketball, Lee Wise, Patty Jo Hedges, Lori Edgington, Sharon Garland, and me. The five of us came in that year and we changed the program. As soon as we touched the court, matter of fact, that summer when we did our Lady Cats basketball camp, people knew that, you know, it was going to be something special that would happen. And we clicked right away again. It was that zone, like it was destiny that we were supposed to be together. And it was just an incredible group. Of course, Debbie Yao leaves the next year, and you know, who knows what would have happened if she would have stayed, but she didn't, and we did what we did anyway. But it was just a magical time. And again, we were in that zone. We were just following our passion, young teenage girls going against, I mean, everyone, because men's basketball was king. And we played and played. We played in the dark. We played at lunch. We played that whenever there was, you know, a chance to get together and play, we were together. And it showed. We took that program. There were probably at the most, I'd say 200, 300 people that would come to games in Memorial Coliseum. I think our first year, we actually were the first team that got to play in Rupp Arena. I don't know if Rupp Arena was built that year or the next. It might have been my freshman year. But we got to play. We were first women's team. We played, I think, maybe five or six games that first year. And that's when Rupp Arena was the first arena built like that for collegiate basketball. And so, you know, with less than 300 fans, when we left UK in 83, we had already broken attendance records. We had, you know, won an SEC title, which, you know, UK hasn't been able to do again, a women's basketball title. And, you know, I ended up owning the records for points and rebounds. And so it was just magical. And in a period, you know, where Title IX was just coming through and we were pioneers. I'd say it was a social movement that we just happened to get caught up into, this whole female thing. And, you know, today you still have athletes fighting about, female athletes fighting about some of the same things, whether it's equal pay, equal, you know, whatever it is, some of those same things are happening today. So, again, it was a magical time for us coming into UK in the late 70s.
Talking with Valerie Still, a charter member of the UK Athletics Hall of Fame, and this year inducted into the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame, and talking about your days at UK. It was certainly an exciting era, thanks to you and your teammates there. And you mentioned Lee Wise and Patty Joe Hedges. You three were kind of the core of a team, and not that you had some other great teammates too, but the Lady Cats, as they were known then, were playing an entertaining and winning brand of basketball. You know, you talked about some of the highlights there, but you played at Rupp Arena there your first year, and Rupp Arena was still a new and fantastic experience for basketball fans at that time, and seating 23,000 and filling it up for men's basketball. And you mentioned the attendance too. Fans who go to the UK women's games today are used to seeing 5,000 and 6,000 at a game, but at that time you had to build up from really from almost nothing, as you mentioned. And there was one game in particular that kind of brought it all to the peak when you upset Old Dominion. And for those who don't remember, Old Dominion was a real powerhouse in women's basketball in the early 1980s.
Oh, yeah.
There was a game at the Coliseum where Kentucky won, and there were over 10,000 people in attendance, and that record stood for years as far as a women's basketball attendance record, as I recall.
Oh, yeah. And that year, I think we broke the record for attendance across the country. But, yeah, and Donovan came in. They were ranked, we had the highest rating that UK has ever been. I think we were fourth at one point. But we played Ann Donovan, who just recently passed away, Hall of Famer, legendary. Ann and I had played in high school. She was in North Jersey. I was in South Jersey. So we had played all-star games. So I was familiar with her. But we broke the record for a women's basketball game. And I think that was – it might have been – I'm thinking it's 82. I can't remember. But we were doing all these incredible things and not knowing, really. We were just having a good time. Mm-hmm. It was – and that's what life's about. You know, when you're following your passion, I keep going back to it. You know, nowadays – people have all these motives, and even young people, you know, whether it's, you know, you're playing because you want to get a scholarship, your parents want you to get a scholarship, or you want to get to the NBA, or you have to have dreams, but at the same time, you just have to go with your passion. You got to do something that you love doing 24/7, and then everything else follows. And that's what we did. And again, we were fighting all these stereotypes, you know. We had a lot of, I know, in my memoirs, you know, I was pretty honest about it. You know, it was the 60s, 70s, 80s. You know, women were looked down upon in certain areas, and we had to deal with that, and we did, and we just kept moving forward. But you can't close your eyes to it, and especially at a school like UK that, again, men's basketball is king and it rules. And eventually, yeah, it changes. You change people's minds and you change their attitudes. But that takes hard work and that takes a lot of growing pains as well. And people who are willing to go through those kind of things and deal with that. And that, you know, we did it. We were able to change people's minds. And even, again, the fight is still there for women's sports to be recognized and valued just as men's sports are.
You got some international experience during your time at UK, and I would imagine that served you well later when you played for years in Italy. But that international experience helped you grow not only as a basketball player, but as a person as well. I know you talked about in the book about how sometimes it was you'd have to take stock and say, "Wow, am I really here? Am I really playing internationally, representing the U.S. and having that kind of experience in your college years, in addition to playing for Kentucky?"
Most definitely, I think my years going to Italy and with UK, we had gone 3 or 4 years every summer. We would go. We had a partnership with Japan, and we would go and play there. And we'd go on tour for 2 weeks and play their national teams or professional women. And they had professional teams back then as well. And so we would go. That gave us some exposure, you know, and I played with the USA national team as well. So it was expanding my, you know, who I was. And when opportunity came where I could play, I thought I was going to play in Japan. And one of my last games, my senior year, there were two agents that came in, two Italian guys that came in and kind of convinced me that I should go to Italy. And that wasn't even on the radar. And I just said I'd take a chance and go for a year. And that expanded me. What Italy did and Europe did was that, you know, in the United States, this systemic racism and sexism that, you know, if you're not, if it doesn't affect you, then you can't understand it until you go to a place where you don't have to deal with that. And when I got to Italy, it was all about my playing. And it was like just liberating because I didn't have to worry about, you know, being discriminated against because I was a person of color or because I was female. The one thing that did happen was that we had a lot of responsibility because there was one American on each team. And if the team did well, they loved, you know, that was good for you. But if the team did not do well, then it was going to come down. It was your responsibility. So that, yes, but it was all based on your playing ability. And so it was just liberating and it empowered me. And I did so many things that I don't think I would have had the chance to do if I would have stayed in the United States. I would have done, you know, I would have been successful at whatever I did, but I don't think it would have made me the person that I am today and to see things that I see in the way that I see them.
There were some situations in Italy that I guess probably helped you become a better business person, seeing the business side of professional basketball,
yeah.
Some difficulty with contracts and things like that. And that's, I guess, all part of the growth as well. I mean, it's certainly better than having to deal with the discrimination that you were talking about. But business is business, I guess, anywhere. And sometimes it can be pretty tough.
Yeah, that's true. That's a great point. And it did, you know, here I am. Here we are, teenage girls. I'm straight out of college, 20, 21, and I'm going to a foreign country I know nothing about and dealing with, you know, the language, the culture, the way of life, everything. And you just mentioned the whole thing of, you know, whether you're going to get paid or not. You know, if you've got an agent or not, sometimes your agent would do, this is like in the orange ages, you know, the dark ages when we were over there. So you didn't know if you didn't play well, you may not get paid. A lot of the players, not a lot, but many of the players would actually leave halfway through the season, whether they were homesick or just couldn't deal with that, you know, the cultural shock or whatever. And so all those things factored in. And here we are, teenage girls, you know, fending for herself and having to, but again, that made me who I am today, those experiences. And sometimes, you know, we want to protect our children. We want to, you know, just nurture them and keep them in a little incubator. But I think all those experiences really, really, they really get you to knowing who you really are.
You mentioned the language barrier, and you had a story in the book about one expression that the coach would use, and the word is spelled D-A-I, but it's pronounced die. So when the coach is yelling at you to die, that's not actually what the coach meant. Tell me about that, what that expression means, and how it fit into your practice there.
Yeah, for at least the first 2 or 3 weeks, I'm like, whoa, this guy's crazy. I thought that he was just going when we got there, we weren't even playing basketball. It was all they called Atletica, where you're doing all training. It's just, you know, on the court sprints and all that kind of stuff. And you hear them saying, die, 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 die. And that just means, come on, let's go, go, go. It really means give me, give me. And I'm like, wow, they are really trying to kill me here, seriously. And then, you know, another funny one was Louie. I kept hearing them say, Louie, Louie. And I'm like, who is this Louie guy? Who is he? And Louie means him. So it's just a pronoun for him. But, you know, just some of the little things that you kind of laugh about now.
Well, you had
a couple of things that I mentioned in the book.
Yeah, you had overall, it sounds like a great adventure and experience in Italy. And then you returned to the U.S. It looked like your playing days were over, but not quite, as the American Basketball League was formed, a women's basketball league. And you had an opportunity with the Columbus Quest. And I would say in the 2 years there that you certainly made the most of it.
Oh, I think, again, a monumental situation I just opened myself up to, and it was a struggle. I really was not in for trying to join a women's professional league, knowing that it was probably not going to be successful. But my assistant coach from Kentucky, Dottie Berry, was working with the ABL at the time. I had just had my son. He was 6 months old. I had retired. You know, I was going to do the mom thing. I had already laid it out. And so I moved back to Kentucky because both me and my former husband, Rob Locke, who was another UK athlete, mm-hmm. We figured we'd come back to UK come back to Lexington because we both had fond memories there. He's from the West Coast. I was from the East Coast. And so we just setting up, you know, I had kind of got established doing some work with a TV station in Lexington, and Dottie Berry called me and convinced me. Took her some time to convince me to go for a tryout up in Columbus, Ohio, and that ended up being, I mean, the American Basketball League really came out before the WNBA, and it really pushed the NBA to move with this professional basketball league for women. And for me, the ABL was a social movement. We really were trying to fight our way into having some respect and, you know, being valued. And it was just probably two or three of the best years of my life. I still have great friends, sisters, Katie Smith, Nikki McCray, who's now coaching No Dominion. Just friendships and experiences that I would have never had if I would have just said, no, I think I'm just going to stay retired. So back in that zone again. And, you know, here I am today. I was one of the few players that, you know, most of the players that played overseas were too old to really join the ABL or the WNBA when it started in 1996. Mm-hmm. I was at the time 35, just had a baby, and women were playing, you know, after they had children, and 35, that's old in any respect for a professional athlete. And I was playing with kids that were just coming out of college. So just a great experience, though, and I was blessed and fortunate enough to be able to have that experience.
And then you also later did play in the WNBA as kind of a capping of your career. We mentioned earlier the induction into the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame earlier this year, and I thought it was interesting, and UK fans would like to know that Debbie Yao was there to support you at your induction, your coach, your first year at UK. I would think we could take that as a good indication of your ties to UK still being strong.
Of course. How would they not be strong? UK, those 4 years, I think for most young people, your college years are fundamental. And to think about when I look back on UK, and not just UK, but the whole experience, there was a sponsorship program that got started. I have my Lexington family. All those experiences, my teammates, there's no way I could replace that. And there's doing those things, historical things. I mean, that what we did at UK has not been replicated. And if you look at how we did it with today is a multi-million, probably billion dollar program where, you know, as far as marketing, promotions, you know, coaches getting $1 million. Mm-hmm. When we were coming in, Debbie, I think, made, I don't know, she made $50,000 a year at the top. That might, I don't even know, I shouldn't even mention probably, because it probably wasn't even that. But it was a time when, you know, none of that was involved. It was all about women who were really passionate about sports. And sports was, you know, it wasn't looked up upon for women. And so, you know, UK represented that. You know, my dream coming out of Camden, New Jersey, was that I wanted to play professional with the Philadelphia 76ers and Dr. J. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, getting to UK, being successful, doing what we did, of course, I bleed blue. That's how could it not be any other way?
Well, we've gone over a lot of the basketball accomplishments, and you talked about having passion for that. And another thing that you've had a lot of passion for is, as you've talked about, looking into the family history, and you are a direct descendant of William Still, a man known as the father of the Underground Railroad. And you wrote a book called Still Alive on the Underground Railroad. Tell me about William Still and about your interest in making sure that his story gets told.
Well, in 2004, I believe I was up in, I was living in Columbus at the time. We were invited to the Freedom Center up in Cincinnati. It was the largest museum, African-American based, and they opened it, and they asked myself, and I took my son as well as representatives of William Still. And I was studying William Still somewhat. I knew a little bit of our family history. But I began to get really into really studying it. And I went back to, I got my master's degree in African and African-American studies at The Ohio State University. And William Still, the movie's out now, Harriet. I know a lot of people have gone out to see that. William Still, if not as important, he was more so important than Harriet Tubman or John Brown, Frederick Douglass. He worked with the Underground Railroad. He documented all the cases, and anyone that was escaping, he documented it. And, of course, it was with the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, sorry, before the Civil War. It was all illegal for you to help anyone that was escaping or for you to, you know, assist anyone. And here he was documenting all these cases because his mother, my great-great-great-grandmother, had to escape. My great-great-great-great-grandfather, his father bought his freedom, but they wouldn't allow his mother for him to buy his mother's freedom. And so she had to escape, and they lived their whole life knowing that she was a fugitive and that she could be recaptured at any time. They moved up. They came in from Maryland. She escaped from Maryland to New Jersey. And so every day they lived with that. She died before the Civil War, so technically she was a fugitive. She died a criminal, according to American law. And William, what he did was, and her older sons, back. So her older sons, she escaped twice. The second time she escaped, she had to leave her older sons, Peter and Levin Jr. And so when she escaped, their owner ended up selling them to a guy named John Fisher in Lexington, Kentucky. And that's how her two older sons, they were only 6 and 8 at the time, but that's how they ended up getting to Kentucky, Lexington, and then they were sold further south to Alabama. But John Fisher, who was in Lexington, Kentucky, lived across the street from Henry Clay and my great-great-grand-uncles, William's older brothers, actually played with Henry Clay's children. And so that's the whole connection with the Stills being my ancestors being enslaved in Lexington. And in my book, I write about it. I've researched it. And, you know, Cheapside Bar and Grill, I know when we were in Lexington, we would go celebrate games and watch games there. And And I did my research, and Cheapside was actually a slave auction, mm-hmm. One of the most noted slave auctions, because, of course, Kentucky was the main, you know, marketing place as far as the trafficking of slaves and that kind of thing. And so Cheapside slave auction was right there in Lexington, Kentucky. And I didn't know any of that history when I was at Lexington. But, you know, the draw for us to come to Lexington, it was strong. It was our destiny to come back to Lexington. And now we get to tell that story. And now William still even, you know, up until this point, many people, the history of the Underground Railroad was that Quakers kind of ran it, and it was predominantly, you know, whites that were really pushing this movement, when in actuality, it was African-Americans, free blacks, and those individuals who were willing to take a stand and to go against the law, because the law was that it was illegal to escape. And so, you know, this whole history, and I've always been a social advocate in the sense that pushing against norms, you know, I'm an anomaly. I'm always pushing. I'm not within. If you look at me, even at UK, it's like, it's not within the norms. Sometimes I say, if I was a white male, I mean, just think how different my experience would be. But I get this history, this experience from my ancestors, who were always fighting against what wasn't right and always fighting for the truth. And so sometimes that's not always a fun place to be, because you'd rather just be going along with the, you know, with the program.
Sure.
But at the same time, I think each one of us, we have to stand up for what's right and be on the right side of history, because eventually it's going to come out. That's like William Steele. Many people did not know about William Steele. His book was published in 1872. He documented every case that came through. He worked for the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society, and he would document every case that came through. He would organize, like he would know someone's coming through. If they needed an attorney, he would organize that. If they needed someone to stay, he would organize that. If they wanted him to get back in contact with their, because some of them would end up in Canada, he would document and write letters and petition. He was William Steele. People think of Martin Luther King having, you know, with boycotts and, you know, sitting on a bus, you know, to boycott, you know, sitting on the back of the bus. William Steele in the late 1800s boycotted the streetcars of Philadelphia. Because blacks weren't allowed, they had to sit in the back, or if it was full, they'd have to sit and hang on the outside of streetcars. And if it was raining, they'd get rained on. And so he actually started a boycott for that. So well before Rosa Parks in the 1960s, William Steele was doing all this. And who knows of William Steele? Not many people do.
It must have been very satisfying.
Oh, it's amazing. This year, I was invited to America Unearthed. It's a show on the Travel Channel, and they were doing an episode on caves that they thought were used for the Underground Railroad, and we got invited to the Pennsylvania Historical Society in the vault, where they keep a copy of the Declaration of Independence, a Constitution. They keep a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation signed by Abraham Lincoln, and along with all these incredible documents is William Steele's own personal journal that he wrote. Mm-hmm. His daughter donated it to the Pennsylvania Historical Society. And here, my ancestor has his document there. And that's part of the reason why I write now and why I felt compelled to write my memoirs, was because the only way people will know about my ancestors is if many people will be because they read my book. And so then it pushes you back to read about William, about his brothers, Levin and Peter, who were enslaved in Lexington. And so it's just a natural thing for me with this type of history that I feel an obligation to carry on that legacy. Sorry about being so long-winded.
Oh, that's all right. I was going to say it must be very satisfying, and I'm sure it was an eye-opener when Lexington, Kentucky popped up in the story, too, so many meaningful years of your life there.
Yeah. It was. Can you imagine that, Keith? And I had been in Lexington. Just think how different it would have been if I would have known this history. Now, I knew about William's older brother was my great-great-grandfather, and he published his autobiography in 1877, and my father had a copy of that, and he would pull it out and, you know, every now and then. But I didn't understand the importance of it. But just to think about a black man in the 1800s writing his own autobiography, publishing it, and being one of the most successful doctors. William Still's oldest daughter, Caroline Still, was a career woman way before I was. I thought playing in the ABL and having my son was something special. She was one of the first female doctors in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, if not the first black female doctor in Philadelphia. And she had children at the time. And so, all these things are role models for me, examples, and it changes who I am. It kind of validates and it kind of explains, you know, some of my drive, the nature, the way I am, because they were already doing these things, speaking out, for civil rights and for human rights. That's my family. And so, most people know me as a basketball player, but that just scratches the surface. Basketball was just a venue for me to do what I'm doing now.
You have one other project, probably many others, but I was going to ask about one other one, the Clarence B. Jones Institute, something that I think you've become involved with since being associated with the schools there and near your hometown. And tell me about that project and how that's working.
Yeah, another thing that just falls when you're in the zone. When I came back to my mom passed away. My dad passed away in 1995, a year before my son, and my mother passed away in 2010. And it was devastating for me because my mother was everything to me. She was the whole reason that I did anything that I did. And she died in 2010, and I ended up coming back to New Jersey. And while I was here, I started just researching her a little more. The house that I had bought for her in 1992, well before any of this happened, was in Palmar. She went to school in Palmar at Palmar High School. She loved her school. And I had never been to her high school with her. She talked about it often. It's a couple blocks from the house where that she lived in, her and my father. But when she died, I was researching, and I ended up going to the high school and just looking through yearbooks and discovered that Clarence B. Jones was a classmate of hers, and discovered that Clarence B. Jones in 1949 graduated with her and then got a scholarship to Columbia University. It was Columbia College in New York, and then ended up being a successful attorney in California. And in the early 1960s, Martin Luther King ends up needs an attorney for some things that he's going through. And Clarence B. Jones, at that time, was one of the leading black attorneys. And he goes out to California and recruits Dr. Jones to be on his team. And Dr. Jones eventually accepts and becomes his speechwriter and his attorney and his confidant and a personal friend. And in 2014, I reached out to Dr. Jones, and we just started. I didn't even know him, and I said, "I'm just going to try and reach out to him." And I told him that, I was William Still's great great grand niece, and just gave him some information, and that Gwendolyn Still was my mother, and He got back in contact. He says, yes, I knew your mother. We were friends. They lived in the same neighborhood. And, I mean, here I am talking to a man who drafted the I Have a Dream speech.
Right.
I mean, how do you even figure that thing out? So we kept in contact. I started a scholarship for him in his name and in my mother's name at the high school. And in 2017, I petitioned the school district to rename the library after him and to bring him back and to honor him. And to also start a nonprofit, the Clarence Jones Institute for Social Advocacy, in which they did. And so I ended up being president. And so we do programs. We do youth empowerment programs, youth leadership programs. We work with the UN. We've been to a few UN conferences recently. In August, we were out in Salt Lake City. But it's just, for me, you know, I always say it's the difference between success and significance. You know, for such a long time, you talk about my records, what I did at UK, you talk about the Hall of Fame, you talk about the trophies, you talk about here and there. It's all just, you know, success is just working and working, getting stuff, get more titles, getting respect. Now that I've reached the point in my life, I've lived more years than I'm going to live. It's all about significance. How can I be... What legacy am I going to leave? What, you know, it's about serving others, altruism, true altruism. And so the Clarence B. Jones Institute for Social Advocacy provides me a venue, an avenue where I can give back to others. I mean, I've been given so much that it's all about giving back. What can I do? And I think one of my greatest recognitions was in 2018, last year, the State of New Jersey awards, the Jefferson Awards, they nominate. And the Jefferson Award is the most prestigious public recognition for public service. And I was one from New Jersey. That was quite an honor. And so my whole life now is about, you know, how can I be significant? How can I help others? And so even with these types of interviews or these types of ways of communicating with others, everything I do is about making our world a better place. And today, with all the craziness that's going on in the world, I think we all need more of that. We just need to, you know, learn how can we bring each other together.
Well, congratulations on that award and on all the accomplishments in addition to all that string of basketball accomplishments that we talked about. It was great to reminisce with you on those. And of course, you've led a very adventurous and accomplished life since then, since the basketball days, and much more to go, of course, but certainly a long list of accomplishments of which you can be very proud, and understandably so. Valerie, it's been a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks so much for taking time today.
Well, Keith, but, you know, I have to give a shout-out to my son, though. I can't,
oh, sure.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I can't, you know, it's always, my son, that's probably my pride, well, not probably, it's my pride and joy. Aaron just graduated from the Naval Academy this May, and is now an ensign in the U.S. Navy, and I just, you know, it's all about giving back. And so passing on that legacy of serving the public, serving his country, I don't think there's a greater honor than that. And so I always give a shout out. You know, it's a way of giving back. So just wanted to give a little shout out. If he's listening, he should be. But
Well, congratulations to him, too. That is a great accomplishment on his graduation from the Academy. So we'll send our congratulations along as well, and wish you well. And if you're in Lexington soon, I hope you have an opportunity to meet up with some of your old teammates or coaches. And I'm sure that's always fun for you, too. But again, appreciate your connection to UK and Kentucky, and best of luck in whatever you take on in the future.
Go Big Blue.
All right. Go Big Blue. Thanks, Valerie.
Thanks, Keith. Take care.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.